hopefully we're still friends. But I just have a few quick questions. And do you, after having a chance to review the different legal opinions, in your mind, do you think that the governor's bill is constitutionally fit?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, as near as we've been able to tell, it is. I recognize there are opposing opinions to that. As I mentioned, I think our view is that although we are persuaded that it is constitutional, if the legislature is uncomfortable with the verification of that, there are technical changes that can be made in the bill to virtually make it certain that it is constitutional.
In your mind, does the governor's bill return federal management to Alaskans, the 60% of the federal lands or 220 million acres?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think, I guess I should ask you about what you mean by that question.
Does the governor's bill retain federal management?
That's what I was wondering about. I don't think we want federal management, I guess, is what I was worried about. The governor's bill does not...
Pardon me?
The governor's bill does not provide for or provide a way for enabling state management on federal lands at the present time. Now, the reason I'm saying that is that there obviously is no way that state legislation can regain state management, because you would have to comply, number one, with federal law before there was consideration of that. And depending on the terms of the federal law, you might not get it anyway. And that's what I was saying before. If the state complies with ANILCA as it presently is written, then the state will not get state management back. You can amend the Constitution, you can comply with ANILCA, you can stoop and bow and meet the terms of ANILCA, and they will say thank you for signing up to manage Alaska's resources, not just on federal lands, but on federal lands, state lands, navigable waters, private lands, according to federal mandates, and make sure you don't screw up, or we'll have you in federal court at our first opportunity. That's what you will get by conforming to ANILCA.
Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, then, if perhaps this piece of legislation does not get state management again, what would happen if restrictive federal management is maintained on 60% or 220 million acres of land, plus the possibility, and I just says the possibility, of native or private lands of 40 million acres of land being closed to the public? Wouldn't this place a tremendous burden on hunting and fishing pressures on state land?
Mr. Chairman.
What, in your sense, would be the potential impact in areas that, if I represent Anchorage or Fairbanks?
Oh. Mr. Chairman, if all that transpired, it would certainly reduce hunting opportunity a great deal. While all that was going on, however, the greatest quantity of Alaska's resources could still be taken under state regulation because they come from the waters, for state navigable waters.
The final question, though,
which includes commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use, fishing. And that's where the bulk of the wild renewable resources taken by Alaskans comes from. And as the governor's office indicated, that and others have indicated, the Department of Fish and Game, that is under state management, state navigable waters. And presently they're in court to try to make darn sure it stays that way.
You brought up the three subjects of commercial, subsistence, and sports. What percentage of our fisheries does each of these uses use? You and I know the answer to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that. I know that
95% for commercial, 4% for subsistence, 1% for sports fishermen. And if the Outdoor Council believes in equal treatment, why don't we divide these resources to third between the three groups? Would you support something like that?
Well, you know, Senator Adams and Mr. Chairman, Mark Twain said there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics. And you just use some statistics about the breakdown of the catch of resources for the various kinds of uses. And they may very well be right. I don't remember. I've seen them before, and there are different ways to figure, you know, what the proportions are. But one thing I would say is that there's no question but what the bulk of the fisheries resources come from commercial fisheries. And there's no question but what the minority of them come from, are used by sport fisheries. But I guess one of the things that has bothered me since I've heard this set of statistics being thrown around lately is I wonder how much of that is fisheries that may not have been subject to either sport or subsistence fisheries. I'm thinking offshore fisheries and so on, you know, that really aren't subject to commercial. I have since learned that the proportion of the take of salmon for subsistence purposes, at least to the extent it's identified, has been fairly small also. So, you know, the point is, commercial does take the majority, but that's understandable. I guess the other part of that is there's a heck of a lot of commercial fishermen that use a part of their commercial catch for their own use, which essentially is their subsistence use. Lots of them, as you all know.
You mentioned Anilka. Do you believe that Anilka will be changed over the objections of the native communities? And your thoughts on the congressional delegation's thoughts on this?
I guess right now I don't think it would be. I guess I would agree that unless the Native community was at least not in opposition to a change, it probably would have a very difficult time in Congress. As far as what the congressional delegation is thinking about it, that's always been a little hard for me to figure out. It may be a little clearer in an election year than other times, though.
Then if that's the case, that we cannot change Anilka, then we should, then your statements, we cannot get to where you want to go if we cannot do that. But would the Outdoor Council be available or to consider to give the people a vote to vote on a constitutional amendment? It just basically says, would you vote for a constitutional amendment? Yes or no. If you said yes, go to page number 2 and the constitutional amendment can have the Outdoor Council or the governor's language. The second one would be the Bush Caucus language. And would you give that opportunity to the people to vote on an option?
Well, let's see. Let me answer that somewhat indirectly, and I don't do that to try to dodge the issue, but just because I can't think of a real direct way to answer it. I'd like to go back and repeat what I said earlier with regard to what's in the Constitution. It's very, very difficult to imagine wording of the Constitution that could be any better in terms of protecting the most basic civil rights of each and every Alaskan than what we have presently. So right off, it's a little hard to imagine that it could be changed without compromising that to some degree. I guess if it came down to is there an amendment that could be voted on that if the question were that did not and was certainly did not, certain that it did not compromise equal rights, equal protection, and common use, then I think that would be a fair question. And I'd say yes if it didn't, and that was, you know, certain. But it's very difficult to be certain about that. We are certain about the present content of the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop. And Mr. Chairman, I just throw that proposal out for food for thought for a later discussion.
I tell you, got two for one there, right, Senator? Sometimes sells a dead horse a couple of times, too. That's very good. Senator Dunn. Thank you. Then Senator Hoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bishop, I just one question for you. You, of course, have read the government bill. You were involved, I'm sure, in how we put that together. As I've been reading the sustained yield definition, of course, this is my reading of the sustained yield definition in the governor's bill, it seems that that definition always requires the boards to give priority to hunting and fishing over non-consumptive uses of fish and game. Some of those non-consumptive uses, an example might be viewing. It seems to me that this sustained yield principle or sustained yield definition always gives that that priority and therefore might prohibit the board from setting aside certain stocks for non-consumptive uses. Do you think the board should be able to set aside certain stocks for non-consumptive uses?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, yes, I do, and in fact, the board does. And as far as I know, there has never been any dispute that that is consistent with the principle of sustained yield. Its populations are managed to provide for ongoing benefits, and generally regarded in consumptive terms, but that does not preclude, within that framework, allocation of parts of those resources for non-consumptive uses, and that seems to have worked reasonably as well.
Have you read the definition of sustained yield in the government?
Yeah, I haven't read it for a couple of weeks or something like that, Mr. Chairman, but I have read it.
Yeah, as I read it, I think maybe it does cause some difficulty. I know I've just read your position paper on several items about non-consumptive use and how you support that. If this provision in the government's bill might prohibit the board from being able to set aside certain stocks for non-consumptive uses, it seems to go contrary to your council's position. I'm just wanting to carefully look at all sections of the government's bill and to demonstrate yourself that you should be in full support of it.
Mr. Chairman, concept of sustained yield is in the Constitution, and I don't think that the definition certainly was not intended to be inconsistent with the idea behind that, nor with general practice as far as wildlife management. And I guess it completely escapes me what point in our policy or review you may be referring to. I don't understand your question in that regard.
Just some paper handed out to me where you support the viewing tag bill for one, and you support the need to make sure that there's and other uses should be provided for when research has recovered, et cetera. And that support, I mean, don't you support viewing?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Yes, all the time.
Yes, you do. And I guess my concern was that the sustained yield, just to make you aware of that, you might want to look to that. That the definition of sustained yield in the governor's bill may prohibit the board from setting aside certain stocks for non-consumptive uses, and that may not be what you want to support, but I just want to be sure you're clearly supporting what you want to support.
Earlier, Mr. Chairman and Senator Duncan, I really appreciate your concern. I think it is consistent with our policy. I think it is consistent with the definition of sustained yield. I do not think that there will be a problem there, but thanks for bringing it to my attention.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank
Senator Lazar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How would you describe Governor Hammond's input to the task force?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the first part of that.
How would you describe Governor Hammond's input to the task force on dumping the compromise legislation as you described it?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I think Governor Hammond was very constructive.
Well, given that, did you get the opportunity to read Governor Hammond's article in May 31st's Sunday paper?
Mr. Chairman, this past Sunday?
No, May 31st.
Oh, May 31st.
On subsistence and the special session.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoff, no, I don't believe I did.
Well, let me read something out of that to you that he stated. He states that three things must be done in this special session. Three things must be done if this special session is not to self-destruct. First, to satisfy the native concerns, a constitutional amendment to grant the highest priority to subsistence use must be placed on the ballot. That's the first one. The second one, he says, amend the governor's bill to eliminate the non-rebuttable presumption qualifying of all those communities of 2,000 or less for subsistence. And the third one, he states that the establishment of a subsistence board is proposed by AFN. Those are the three things that Governor Hammond says must be done. And I wonder if you agree with those three.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I guess my first reaction is I'm sure glad he waited till after we finished meeting before he brought those up. Or we'd still be there. But my second comment is, no, I do not agree with those. I do not think that those are either necessary, or I don't think any of them are necessary, and I certainly do not think that the constitutional amendment, I think you said rural priority, nor the subsistence bill are desirable.
Senator Lyson? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was, Senator Hoffman alluded to one of the questions I have relative to what took place at these meetings. I don't know if the article said 2,000 people. I think the plateau was 2,500. But it's my understanding that there has to be some type of criteria set for each one of these population factors in order to give some type of constitutional strength to the bill. That's my understanding. You just couldn't say any community with 3,000 or less people is automatically into a subsistence lifestyle, period. Somewhere in that legislation has to be some type of criteria set, even though it's very minimum. The question I have is that in relationship to those communities with less than 2,500. Of course, yesterday we had an impression, at least I had an impression, many people, elders from different remote areas of Alaska came to testify against this bill in favor of the AFN bill. But what puzzled me is why, in fact, they would be, if they came from those areas, which really are affected minimally, the governor's bill, is, in my estimation, doesn't affect them whatsoever. They can continue on what they've always done and on to the future. So I guess the question would be that with 2,500 or less, they are presumed to meet the requirements, so which is sort of a blanket presumption. However, there has to be some type of criteria there in order to get out of that problem we have in the world. So it goes on to say, the state has to, can be rebutted only by the state by clear and convincing evidence. What degree of evidence is that? It seems to me quite high that they have to be in effect, really not subsistence users. Mm-hmm. So what, there's different categories of evidence. How high would that be?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lyson, I really don't know. Because I don't know the legal terms, my understanding is that that's, if it isn't the highest, it's close to the highest level of standard or proof or whatever it's called that the state has to use in, if, for example, they were to rebut somebody's eligibility. And that's all I know about it, is supposedly that's, you know, the highest or close to the highest standard of proof.
I assume that rebuttal would take place only because of a complaint filed by others in that area saying this particular person is certainly not eligible for subsistence. They'd have to build a case convincing evidence that he wasn't before he would be disqualified. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Eliason, when we discussed that, I think that was really a point of discussion of how much difficulty that would cause among friends, neighbors, folks in the same community, and so on. Basically, what it was intended was that if necessary, the state could challenge somebody's priority right. If, for example, for whatever the reason, there was a high probability that that person really didn't meet the individual criteria, which are the guts of the bill. Everybody, no matter where they are, no matter where they live, are supposed to meet the same individual criteria. If the person in this rural area didn't meet them or didn't appear to meet them, the state could say, this doesn't look quite right, and proceed to develop some evidence as to whether the person met them. If they met them, then there would be no problem. If they didn't meet them, then they could withdraw that priority privilege to the state.
I believe I have the answer here. There's three levels. One is beyond reasonable doubt, lowest level, medium level, clear and convincing, and the high plateau is preponderance of evidence, which is very difficult in most cases to reach. So I would presume under that criteria that these people that testified yesterday, who live in these small remote areas, should have no concern whatsoever that all be entitled to subsistence under the governor's bill. Can you tell me any differently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lassen, no, that's exactly right. In those areas, under the governor's bill, all of the people in those areas would be assumed to meet the individual criteria at the outset.
And other questions? No. Senator Carr.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one, declaration. In your view, have we lost basically management of our game resources? Or will we lose management of our game resources after July 1? Pretty good ag on federal lands.
Mr. Chairman, let me restate it in case I didn't hear you correctly. I think the question is, will we lose after July 1 the management of our game resources on federal lands? And is that correct? I think it's yes for sure in part, and that relates to subsistence management, subsistence allocation, and it's probably with regard to other aspects of management. There really still is a question, a legal question, whether the feds have the authority to do anything more than manage subsistence allocation. There is an argument to be made for the state still having authority for other aspects of management and allocation of wildlife game on federal lands. And I don't think there is an answer to that yet. So the first part is yes, we'll lose it with regard to subsistence allocation. The second part is, I think, probably or maybe, with regard to management and allocation of other uses of game.
And you think then that the governor's bill is going to thwart that action?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Zaroff, know that it will not thwart that action. In fact, there's nothing that this legislature can do before July 1 that will thwart that action, in my opinion. That's set by the procedure that the feds are going by. They're going to complete that procedure one way or another, and there's nothing in the purview of the state to interrupt it.
You think, you know,
other than possibly signatures
here, Mr. Chairman, you think possibly then, if the legislature during the special session were to adopt a constitutional amendment which would go to the vote of the people, that there could be an argument made to the Department of Interior to hold off to see whether the state does adopt that or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Zaroff, that argument could certainly be made. I guess I am dubious that it would have any effect.
Do you think that would have more of an effect there than passing a bill that we haven't determined whether it's constitutional now or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Zaroff, I think it would be about a wash.
I'd give a better percentage than that.
Thank you. There's no question. It's the intention of the chair at recess for 10 minutes, but subsequent to that, we'll cross the face of the state, have 3 to 5 minute testimony from the people for about 1 hour. Then tomorrow we'll continue testimony in a given time, but we'll start with Sandy Mantoff, probably go to Eric Ford, but I'm going to go across the face of the state geography for brief testimony. And about 1 hour after we come back to order, we'll bring the bill up. So I ask the staff, attorneys, and so on, and administration have the materials ready to start explaining the first bill before us, which is 484. We'll go right on into it.
Wow.
Well, now that we only have rural legislators here, we'll start bringing in the rural. Come back to order. And it's our intention to have relatively brief testimony by individuals. Some of you will be representing organizations. And we'll do that for about an hour today. Then we'll go into the body of the bill, and then we will take testimony again tomorrow. At 1:15 tomorrow, Vern Wiggins, Marty Super, Department of Interior, will be on a teleconference we have to set up here. And Lance Nelson will be available in the morning to update the Committee on Subsistence Litigation about 9:30 at the beginning of our meeting. Well, we want to put in an hour of initiating ourselves to the administration's bill this late afternoon upon finishing the concluding this part of the testimony. I'm going to hopefully be half fair, and that is I'm going to try to bring people from across the state in to testify on the face of it. So at this time, Sam Dementoff is here. I'll ask Sam to come forward and those people will be showing up. You are recorded. Others will be here shortly. I'm distressed that more aren't here at the moment, but I think we probably have at least a reasonable cross-section of people and attitudes on legislation. Sam, please introduce yourself and start in.
Yes, my name is Sam Dementoff. I'm the executive director of the Fairbanks Native Association. I'm a member of the Tanana the Chiefs Conference Subsistence Task Force. I'm also a member of the Doyle Limited Board of Directors. I'm opposed to the governor's bill. I support the Bush Caucus bill. I was in Huslia on Sunday afternoon on business, and I talked to five people up there. Fred Byfield, Wilson Sam, who's the chief of the village, Franklin Simon, Bill Derendorf, and Q Byfield. Our discussions were around subsistence and what is going on down here in Juneau. They expressed to me a real concern that this subsistence question is being brought up now without any real input from the people in the rural areas that are affected by the subsistence question because it is their life. I told them that there's reason for the set special session and that the governor called a special session, which really has disrupted a lot of our lives, a lot of our schedules, and thinks in his mind that he can get this question answered. I told them that I'd tell you that of their concerns, that they don't have a chance, except for the people that are down here now. But the true subsistence users, there are a lot of them here, the elders. Some of those people are not going to be able to testify before you. I just want to let you know that. We have an elder in the Tanana Chiefs Conference area. His name is Peter John, and he's the traditional chief there.
I know Peter.
Peter John, I think, would say, along with the elders, what is subsistence? What is subsistence? And he'd say, what is subsistence to you? I think that he would say subsistence is the use of Alaska, its natural resources, earth, air, and water, by its people. Well, how would you include the air and the water into the use or subsistence? The air is used, of course, it supports life. It produces the water cycle, where you can see and read the weather. The elders use that to predict how to hunt and where to fish. The water supports life, the animals, the plants, fish to spawn in, to drink, and the earth supports everything else. I think he'd explain it that way. Where is subsistence located? In the governor's bill, according to the attorney general, he says that it's need. No, it's not need.
It is where the subsistence is. Where is the fish and game? Where is the natural resource? Is it around the cities and villages? No, it's out in the rural areas. Rural preference. Natural. Something that is out there, that's where the people will get it. Who knows about subsistence? Who knows about subsistence? Is it you? Is it me? Is it the people here that are not born here? Is it anyone in the news media? Or is it those elders? Those elders there. They live it. They live it. They explain it as life. It is life. Subsistence is life. They're the ones who knows about it. The Outdoor Council? They changed their name from Alaska Sportsmen to the Outdoor Council. There's a connotation there. They were sportsmen people in the beginning, but now they're saying the Outdoor Council. There's a misperception of there, right there. United Fishermen of Alaska. What is that? The elders, or anybody would say, that's a commercial fishing operation. It's commercial fishing interests. The true subsistence users are the elders, and if anyone needs any guidance on subsistence, including this committee and the rest of us that live here, we get that guidance from the elders. You ask Will, or anyone here, how do we treat the elders? We treat them with respect. We all should treat them with respect. If anyone knows about subsistence and is a true subsistence user, it is the elders. They're right there. Just look at them. They're right there. They're the ones that should be guiding this. I think they are the ones that should have been the experts in the testimony before this committee in the beginning. The Attorney General says, put it in second gear and let it ride for 2 years. No. The subsistence question is a life question. Mackay Campbell says, I'm not really a true subsistence user. He isn't. What is he doing? There's the elders. Ask them what about subsistence is. They'll tell you. My dad is a boat operator, and if he hires people that works on that boat, anybody, he hires people that knows about the boat operation. He kicked them guys right off. Ask a pilot about piloting. They ask other pilots. Ask subsistence about subsistence, and who is questioned? Who is asked? Who gives guidance? It should be those elders. Definitions on subsistence could be use and occupancy. What is use and occupancy? Use of the resources. Occupancy of the land. That's the way that should be defined. Things can happen. Things are happening all over the world now in this state because of the economic conditions, the oil revenue declines. People are going to start losing their jobs, and when they do, if they already aren't doing it now, they're going to start wondering, where am I going to support myself? That includes anybody here, especially in the urban areas. Where are they going to go? They're going to start looking to subsistence. The real dollar is then going to be of value. The dollar that we deal with today, the dollar, the greenback, it's not going to have value in a time like that. The value is subsistence because it supports life. Where would we be right now? Where would Dick Bishop and the other fellows here, or the guy, or Harris, 50 years, 55 years, telling us how long they've been here? Where would they be if it wasn't for Native elders teaching them about subsistence? And that's life, that's survival. That's survivable of people, and it isn't just Native people, it's all Alaska's people, and that's what the Bush Caucus Bill does. I support the Bush Caucus Bill, and I believe that the state of Alaska's people would like to vote on that. Would they support? Who would they support? They would support themselves. They believe in survival. They're supporting themselves if they vote. To give themselves a chance to vote on this issue. And I believe that they should be given a chance to vote on this issue.
Other question?
No, I'm not done yet.
You hesitated, so I thought you were done.
I know. There's a reason why the Native people believe in the Bush Caucus Bill, because it's a way of life and sharing things with people. They are not saying, save this for the Native people. The elders are saying it's for all people. The Bush Caucus Bill says that, and I support that. I'm done.
No question. Thanks very much. Eric,
I'll have you on next week.
Recognize that some will wish to provide greater testimony. I think Eric is one, but I ask that you condense it the most you can. That's all.
My name is Eric Fuhrer. I live in Juneau. I was on the Governor's Subsistence Task Force. As I understood the structure of the force, there were six public members who did not represent anything other than their own experience in the state, of which I was one. Subsequently, three more members were appointed who did represent groups, and it was a very healthy structure in the end, because the representatives of the groups could speak clearly from their group's position, and the individuals could speak to align themselves as the arguments persuaded them. I have a written statement which I have chopped down to some extent in the interest of time. So if something doesn't quite connect, it's because there's a page that's been thrown out.
Yeah, please use the necessary time. Right?
Thank you.
No, you want it.
In the beginning was the land. Then came the fish, the game, and the intricate biosphere. Then came the Aboriginal inhabitants, who have been in Alaska so long that their tribal memories do not record their arrival. Then from the west came Russians, from the east Europeans. Then came technologies which broke the age-old relationship between human population and locally available energy and prey species. And then, with rising population, came the social pressures with which we are wrestling today. One reason for controversy is the practical problem of allocation. Who gets to harvest and who doesn't is the business of regulation. And this must be worked out because the state constitution requires management of renewable resources for sustained yield. The available harvest levels of fish and game in the state are not close to the quantities that would be necessary to feed the population in the pre-contact sense of 100% dependency upon the land. Available harvest levels cannot support even the native population alone. It is a squeeze between the available harvest of wild stocks and an increasing human population that heats up the controversy. Attempts to structure the regulation of fish and game lead directly to the thorny tangle of defining groups who might be awarded or denied special rights. One is then led further to the definition of the beneficial uses themselves, to definitions for many terms used in the history of the subsistence management, and to a definition for subsistence. There are few clear, uncontested definitions in this entire enterprise, although some are less troubled than others. In order to understand the subsistence issue, it is helpful to take a look at the issue at the uses of fish and game, as arguments made by competitors for the resources tend to be classified along the lines of the type of use in which they participate. Individuals, of course, most often participate in more than one type of use, and not infrequently in all types. There are four generally recognized camps or groups in contention over the human use of other species. Three of these are known by the names by which they are regulated, and they are commercial, sport, and subsistence. These three are called beneficial uses from a term that occurs in the Alaska State Constitution. The fourth group is the general public or national interest. The national interest is a surreal conglomerate, which includes all three beneficial uses, as well as preservationists, conservationists, developers, and others. Consequently, in terms of a definition, it is a shifting target, as different and even contradictory values are proposed to be in the national interest. the inability to know or predict what sensibilities will be in the ascendancy of the camp called national interest makes spokesmen for the three beneficial uses in Alaska uneasy about federal regulation. Different arms of the federal government show no tendency toward mutually consistent policy. For instance, Alaska is faced with federal takeover of fish and game management on nearly half the state in order to protect the subsistence rights of rural residents. However, federal law also prevents the taking of fish or game in the national parks. Thus, one of the first consequences of federal protection of subsistence rights is the prevention of subsistence and commercial harvest in Glacier Bay. Because of the growing strength of preservationist philosophy, I am among those who fear that the park's prohibition may eventually be extended to include all federal land. Thus, what starts as a protection for subsistence may become a blanket prohibition. McDowell versus the state was argued on the basis of equal rights and equal access to public resources. And I agree that we should not be dragged back from this constitutional position, for only this position will enable us to make progress toward equality. However, this argument does not imply that there is currently a level playing field. A source of frustration for native subsistence users and others is that arguments for the equality of all are used without regard to the current state of spiritual annihilation and deep inequality that presently exists between the dominant culture of European origin and American Aboriginal inhabitants. One culture's defining activities, in effect a religious structure, are another culture's evocation, and the gulf between these two meanings for the same term is at the core of the difficulty. If those who make the most shrill arguments for equality in the subsistence debate were ever heard to make the same arguments when it was not directly in their interest to do so, a considerable distance between the protagonists might be closed. On the other hand, I believe that it does Native leaders no honor to argue for special rights based on racial groupings, and that it does the Native population no favor to grant such rights in law. Special rights are inconsistent with the ideal of equality, and they are a source of trouble because they set the enabled group aside and encourage harassment, non-cooperation, and alienation between peoples who must ultimately go down the same road. I do believe that it is possible to establish regulation within which Native cultures can practice those cyclic rituals of harvest that defined their lives in the past and which we know as subsistence use. This must be regulation under which all users can operate without resorting to overt and clumsy reliance on racial or residence criteria. And I believe that the governor's proposed legislation satisfies these conditions. Although it was quite unpopular and has resulted in turmoil for fish and game management for the interim, I think that the McDowell decision making rural residence criteria unconstitutional was a correct decision. The term rural is and will remain beyond the reach of a usable definition. That stage of development to which it refers in the contiguous 48 states is nearly non-existent in Alaska. Urban and rural are not the only two possible alternatives on the path of development. In Alaska, there is also wilderness. Villages set in the middle of wilderness are not rural. This is made clear when it turns out that those communities known as the regional hubs, many of whose inhabitants are people with deep ties to the bush and to subsistence, do not fall within the federal definition of rural. Residents of Bethel, for instance, would be probably denied subsistence rights under the language and definitions of Anilka. Conversely, a resident of a smaller town who could be anybody from a highline fisherman to a bank president might be eligible for subsistence rights. Native citizens of the largest Native community in the state, namely Anchorage, would not be eligible. School superintendents and air taxi operators based in villages would be. Reliance on the concept of rural versus urban is hopelessly flawed, and this understanding helps clarify the problem the state faces in any attempt to comply with the letter of the law of Anilka and simultaneously provide a regulatory scheme that is a fair one. Mr. McDowell is an urban sportsman, and the McDowell decision is associated with the beneficial use called sport. Sport is a troubled designation. The spectrum of use and behavior to be found under the umbrella of field sports ranges from the barbaric to the uplifting. Possibly because of the barbaric end of the scale, sportsmen's groups tend toward a defensive tone when making arguments in their own behalf in public. On the face of it, they have a difficult argument to make in defending sport, greed, entertainment, against the breed livelihood and food for the family. The image of the sportsman challenging subsistence criteria is that of a fully engaged middle or upper class Caucasian residing in an urban center throwing his, definitely his, weight against less advantaged native citizens. It is equal treatment under the law upon which legal challenge has been based, and the image of the powerful making this argument against people suffering considerable cultural stress is the reason that the call for equal treatment has been so poorly received. The popularity of sport uses and the reason so many are drawn to them is that they make an elemental connection to the land and are a building block of a sense of identity for participants. At one end of the scale, as the activity of sport use has become further removed from its direct connection to a food source, the motivations and forms for sport activities have become confused. The lore of urban sportsmen is no longer connected in the main to the realities of the field. If their publications are to be believed, they entertain themselves with all sorts of sensationalism and promote and trade in equipment and weapons of all sorts in order to protect themselves should they ever get to the wilderness. Meanwhile, out in that same wilderness, all kinds of activities occur, including the activities of older native ladies who move about unarmed in the pursuit of berries, grasses, and fish. At the other end of the scale, there are many individuals who have never killed anything for sport, yet hold sport licenses. Philosophically and spiritually, they are essentially subsistence users. And if they do their harvesting under the designation of sport, it is a matter of circumstance, sport licensing being the only regulatory form provided. This essential connection between subsistence and sport is one of the arguments made against the regulatory elimination of sport use in order to continue to allow a subsistence harvest on diminishing resources. It is a good argument and illustrates the difficulty of thinking and regulating in the absence of clarifying definitions. The connection between sport use and subsistence and sustenance, or protein for the home freezer, is a nearly universal one for resident Alaskans. But Alaskans who harvest under any rules are up against a growing strength of numbers of people opposed to hunting and fishing on moral and ecological grounds. Numbers of bird watchers are beginning to challenge the tradition of bird hunters. I think that sportsmen, subsistence users, and game management personnel nearly all agree that bird hunting is more directly connected to bird conservation than is bird watching. There is an apparent irony here, and this is a difficult argument to make against urban residents who have no cultural or personal knowledge of the act of harvesting protein for their own dinner. There are a few clues about the kind of thinking that is beginning to be in the majority and will have increasing influence on national policy. One such clue is a question that is occasionally asked by tourists of the Park Service personnel at Denali National Park. The question is, what do you do with the animals in the wintertime? A startling number of bird watchers and their ecologically sensitive urban brethren of all stripes are in fact entirely removed from substantive knowledge about fish and game. That this question is not atypical is a reflection that federal policy is driven, at least in part, by citizens who have lost all real connections to the land. The notion that the world is some sort of zoo and that unnamed government agencies do something with all the animals out there in the wintertime is so far removed from reality that it is quite frightening to realize that this thinking is driving the creation of federal management policy. While subsistence use came first in some sense, commercial use followed immediately as part and parcel of human contact. Commerce between individuals and groups is as old as man's tread upon the continent. When Soviets and Europeans eventually showed up in Alaska, they came as commercial users in sea mammal and fur trades. An argument is made by subsistence users that customary barter and trade, a recognized part of subsistence practice, shades imperceptibly into commercial use. This argument is used to defend the practice of selling parts of subsistence caught fish and game. This may include non-edible parts such as bone and fur used in crafts and edibles such as salmon roe. The whole picture of commercial fishing in Alaska is complex and has nationwide and worldwide aspects. Commercial fisheries, issues, and manipulation by outside interests were one of the main considerations in the fight for statehood. Overcapitalization, offshore draggers with company headquarters in Louisiana, factory trawlers harvesting tens of millions of pounds, the king crab fleet presiding over a decimated species, heavy foreign investment. This is alienation within the very ranks of commercial use. But these monster fisheries have not run afoul of conflict with subsistence regulation. It is the locally based skiff and small boat fisheries, harvests by Alaskans, that are threatened by the state's inability to find a mechanism for the management of subsistence. For village residents, commercial fishing in their local rivers is a major or sole source for cash income, and the subsistence priority of which they are the beneficiaries works against their own interests in the economy. This situation has resulted in native groups being pitted against each other in allocation fights, and once again we are drawn back to the pressure of population levels in a finite world. In spite of the complexities, commercial fisheries help provide local populations all over the state with their sense of identity, their economic base, and indeed their sustenance. This last begins to sound like a description of subsistence use to which I am finally drawn. In 1963 and 1964, it was my privilege to be the only Caucasian fishing commercially on the Oregon Pond River. I was able to succeed because two Eskimo fishermen acted as my guardians and made it their business to see me through to the end of the seasons. They and their contemporaries taught me about fishing and about the Big River. This way of life, close to the water and the country, provided me with a spiritual framework from which I have drawn strength ever since. I call this framework a sense of place, and on various occasions I have argued for the importance of a sense of place to the health of individuals and the strength and diversity of the national spirit. Mr. Chairman, it is the erosion of the physical relationships of a place and the dilution and loss of knowledge about methods of sustaining life that constitute the main ingredients of culture shock. Certainly, thank you. Certainly, for that generation of native subsistence users who show up at public meetings in order to testify as they do with forthright eloquence, subsistence is not something in which they engage occasionally, nor is it a structure to be found within state fish and game regulations. Subsistence is who and what they were for all the generations of the past, and the power of subsistence over the identity of practitioners is the power of symbolism. But the physical realities of 20th century life and the structure of the symbol of subsistence do not coincide is a symptom of the relentless tide of technologies and events that sweeps down upon us all. I come to this argument from the roots of my youth, and I am forced to a bitter conclusion. Already for some years, and as far into the future as we can see, subsistence as it exists in the memories of those eloquent elders is no more. For subsistence to work, an elementary and ruthless biological balance is necessary, and there is no such balance. In biology, this is known as a feedback loop. When a prey species is so reduced as to be unable to support a predator species, the predators have three alternatives. They can move, they can seek other prey, or they can starve to the point that their own numbers can be supported by the diminished prey. Now, and for many years past, there is a fourth alternative. This is the delivery of alternative energy by modern transport. This has already changed the form of life for all the former subsistence cultures, from a nomadic existence balanced on the knife edge of available resources to a network of permanent villages, which are recipients of imported energies from cash to pilot crackers. Worldwide, nationwide, and statewide, the powers of science and civilization have eliminated balance in human development. At the top of this complex situation is human population, and by numbers alone, the Alaskan land and wild species cannot sustain the native population, much less the total population. In spite of devastation by introduced diseases in the last century, modern medicine and outside food supplies have enabled populations to survive lean times, then to double and double again. Even special privileges will not solve the problem of excessive pressure on hunted species. The starving time has been eliminated from the cycle of subsistence. A hunter carrying a weapon made of tool steel, wearing rubber boots, driving an outboard-powered plywood skiff, and wearing sunglasses may well be a subsistence hunter in spirit. But his effectiveness is that of a technological man, and his responsibility to regulate himself must reflect this reality. In the beginning was the land. At the very core of the subsistence issue, at the core of the beneficial uses when all else is stripped away, is the question of the meaning of life. Life in terms of food, in terms of connections, in terms of an activity involving time and knowledge about other forms of life. One of the mental tools for wrestling with this essentially unknowable mystery is a sense of place. For myself and others, a crucial part of this sense is involvement with sport, commercial, and subsistence use on grounds we know well. Alaskan fishermen return year after year to their customary grounds, and the reason they do is not to be found in harvest poundage or mindless habit. If you doubt this, look at the emotional response of the fishermen in Prince William Sound to the loss of their grounds after the big spill. Rock-hard toughies were seen sobbing on national television, and it is my opinion that the depth of their emotion was a surprise even to themselves. Their tears did not fall because of lost money. It was the loss of their own identities and the loss of the possibility of that identity for their children. Losing rights to commercial harvest inside national parks or on federal lands, losing subsistence rights to national interest sensibilities, these are steps down the road of alienation. In years to come, when sociologists are standing around scratching their heads about high alcohol consumption and social violence, we will be lucky indeed if they even remember those activities that used to provide a spiritual framework, but which have ceased to exist. In order to survive, we must evolve mentally, or nature will impose upon us the fate of evolving physically. It follows that compromise and adaptation to our technologies and population levels is necessary. This is a painful process, and so challenging that far more species than currently exist have failed this ultimate test of a face-off with changing conditions. Rapidly changing conditions are what subsistence users and everybody else are up against. So the subsistence controversy is far more than an allocation battle or a clarification of constitutional principles. It is, in fact, a struggle about paths which the human race may take, and it is part of the centuries-old search for the meaning of life. Mr. Chairman, of all the purposes, pursuits, and issues contained within the subsistence controversy, there is one overriding item at the top of the list, and that is the loss of the state's right to manage the harvest. The activities associated with the beneficial uses are part and parcel of our identity, and we have the right and the responsibility to be our own managers. The idea that there is a lasting federal commitment to protect subsistence rights is a chimera. The feds manage the fur seal harvest, and there is no more harvest. The feds offer to protect subsistence, and this protection includes a blanket prohibition against all harvest in Glacier Bay and the other parks, including harvest activities on the outside coast. The governor's legislation that is before you was crafted at a table at which all major pieces of the puzzle were ably represented. To the surprise of the members of the commission, they left the process with a new understanding and respect for the size of the question against which they were historically aligned. We worked on this legislation word by word. It has a good sense of balance and fairness, and it protects the beneficial use called subsistence. I urge you to adopt the governor's proposal. It is a substantial piece of the structure needed to rescue dearly held rights to fish and game use. The governor's legislation is fair and workable, and it will stand us in good stead as the future brings changing conditions to us all. Thank you very much for hearing me out.
Any questions?
Eric, Mackay Campbell said during council meetings that Colonel Jordan of the Fish and Wildlife Protection Office had told him that the bill would only work if it is supported and agreed to by the greater majority of residents. What do you think about that statement at this particular time, sir?
Well, I think that the issue is so complex, and I think that because subsistence forms a nearly religious structure, that arguments based on logical sequences have a tendency to fail. I think that the legislation does need majority broad support, and I think that when it is understood, if it is given a chance to work, that it will get that support.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No further questions. I'd ask Donnie Flegel to come up.
Mr. Chairman.
Are there questions?
No, I just would like to ask if you could make those comments available to committee members.
Yes. Can that be Xerox?
Yes, probably Mackay Campbell's office can make copies available.
Okay, that's fine. If not, we will.
Thank you.
I'm trying to go across the states, McGrath, Ms. Flegel, and we're going to go with central area.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Donnie Flegel, and I live in McGrath. My father testified earlier. I represent four villages in rural Alaska located in the upper Kuskokwim River area within the Doyon and Tanana Chiefs region. I sit on a village corporation board and a tribal government council. The governor's legislation, in many people's opinions, will not return fish and game management on federal lands to the state of Alaska should it become law. I think it was Senator Eliason that asked, what do people from rural areas, what are they worried about? It's federal management. We already understand state regulations. It's a little more difficult when you have two systems operating. At least we can come to Juneau, we can find people, we can get answers. Washington, D.C. is a long ways away. In my area, it's already proving to be both confusing and frustrating because the rules are not the same. For rural Alaskans, and more particularly Alaskan Natives, use and dependence on the renewable resources is a given and so integrated that we find it hard to view as separate from our way of life. However, it is one of the major issues that is polarizing the state and its people. It's probably more to the point in my family. I fully support a resolution to the matter by ensuring that subsistence rights are protected, thereby bringing the state into compliance with ANILCA and returning fish and game management on federal lands to the state. We all have to live in the state, and I'd like us all to get along and share those renewable resources. In the McGrath area, we're seeing more and more people from outside, from the lower river areas, coming up to hunt on the lands that we're used to using. I expect that we'll probably see more of that as lands are closed to certain hunts. If the state legislature and governor cannot pass a bill, perhaps our state's governing body can envision a solution that will include putting this issue before the great people of the state of Alaska at the November election in the form of a constitutional amendment. Perhaps only then can a direction be truly forthcoming. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there questions, Ms. Weaver? Thank you for appearing. Good to see you. Is Claire Swan here?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and ladies and gentlemen, my name is Claire Swan, and I'm here today to testify in my capacity as chairperson of the Kenai Indian Tribe on the Kenai Peninsula. I, like most of the members of the tribe, live on the Kenai Peninsula. For most of our history, we have relied upon the bounty of the sea and the land for our continued physical and cultural well-being. Yet, since the late 1970s, we have been forced to fight to preserve our cultural right to hunt and fish. We have made proposal after proposal to the various boards of fisheries. We have lobbied our legislators, and as a last resort, we have sued the state in both the state and federal courts. We don't relish this continual struggle. We, like virtually all other Native groups in Alaska, long for a permanent solution, one that will allow us to continue to engage in subsistence uses and guarantee our long-term survival as a people. Unfortunately, the governor's bill does not provide that solution, and for that reason, I urge you to reject it. If enacted, the governor's bill would, with or without a constitutional amendment, prohibit those of us who live on the Kenai Peninsula from full participation. Although the governor has stated that his bill will allow all Alaska residents who rely on subsistence, whether by choice, necessity, or heritage, to continue to do so, the structure of his bill makes that impossible for people who live on the Kenai Peninsula. And this is because the governor's bill exempts every fish stock and game population found on the Kenai Peninsula from subsistence uses. Yet those are the very fish stocks and game populations that we have customarily and traditionally used for centuries. It is quite clear that the governor's bill was designed to exempt the Kenai Peninsula from the reach of the subsistence priority, not because there are no customary and traditional subsistence uses taking place on the peninsula, but because other user groups compete for the same resources. Rather than draft legislation that would protect legitimate subsistence users on the Kenai Peninsula, the state has elected to once again favor sport and commercial interests over legitimate subsistence users. It should be painfully obvious to all of us that the state cannot and will not solve the subsistence problem so long as it continues to favor commercial and sport interests over the needs of subsistence users in places like the peninsula. After all, refusal to deal fairly with legitimate subsistence users led to the Madison decision. It also caused the federal courts to invalidate the state's definition of rural in the Kenaitse case, and it led to the invalidation of the state's 1986 subsistence law in McDowell. Every one of those cases arose as a result of the state's policy decision to exclude subsistence users who live on the Kenai Peninsula from eligibility for the priority. Our Supreme Court has said that all Alaskans who are eligible by lifestyle for the subsistence preference must be treated equally, no matter how hard that may be for the state's resource manager. The governor's proposed bill ignores that advice and continues the same failed policy. It makes it difficult, if not impossible, for legitimate subsistence users on the Kenai Peninsula to qualify for the subsistence priority. Now, I know that proponents of the governor's bill have loudly proclaimed that the bill guarantees the right to subsistence hunting fish to all Alaska residents who are legitimate subsistence users. According to the governor, all we have to do is meet detailed individual criteria. But I fail to see how we will qualify the Kenaitse Pim for the subsistence priority under those criteria. Because one is eligible for the subsistence preference only if he or she meets seven standards measured on a cumulative point system. You receive points only if, during the preceding 12 months, you demonstrate that you consumed a minimum of 125 pounds of a mandatory minimum number of species of fish and game taken from a given subsistence use area. You must prove that you engaged in the taking of that fish or game in a given subsistence use area over a minimum of 30 days, and those days must have occurred in a minimum of 4 months. Now, since the Kenaitse have customarily and traditionally harvested, processed, and shared fish and game located near their homes on the eastern coast of Cook Inlet and not in one of the governor's subsistence use areas, they're not going to be able to meet these individual criteria. Subsistence remains an absolute necessity for the cultural survival of the Kenaitse people. It is part of who we are, and without it, we are lost. The governor's bill ignores our needs and continues a policy choice of favoring sport and commercial users over subsistence users by once again excluding residents of the Kenai Peninsula from eligibility for the subsistence priority. The irony of this policy is that historically the Cook Inlet subsistence salmon harvests have consisted of less than 0.5% of the total average annual Kenai Peninsula harvest of over 4 million salmon. There is simply no reason to exclude legitimate subsistence uses of fish and game found on the Kenai Peninsula. You have the opportunity to resolve this controversy fairly once and for all, and you can do that by rejecting the governor's bill and giving the people of the state the right to vote on a constitutional amendment that will allow the legislature to enact a fair and balanced subsistence statute, one that treats all subsistence users fairly, including those who live on the Kenai Peninsula. Thank you.
Good question. Senator
Collins. For quite a while, I thought some friends of mine were getting subsistence permits to put set nets out around Homer, catch silvers, and I think you could get 25 for the head of household and an additional 10 for each other member of the family. I found out later, after I paid a little closer attention, that they weren't subsistence fishing after all. It was personal use. Mm-hmm. And they were... We were allowed to harvest fish in that fashion, and so if a family was allowed, say a family of five was allowed somewhat 50 fish or something like that, how would that differ in the amount of fish you would take as a subsistence user on the Kenai Peninsula? Is it close? Or?
Well,
you seem to have left personal use out when you talked about opportunities on the Kenai Peninsula.
Well, because everybody here has talked about there's so many labels you have. So I was just not sticking that in there. But personal use is called by many people who use it on the peninsula as subsistence. It's subsistence, but it really is very confusing because at this time you can get 5 kings and 25 sockeye in a subsistence net or for personal use fishing. The sports people are allowed to keep the king salmon that are 52 inches in length or over. You probably know that Kenaitse has an educational net. We have a 60-foot educational net with a permit. And we are not able to fish because we have to put the king salmon back, and we don't know what in the world we do with the ground king salmon, so we just don't put our net out. So it's, I can't tell you what people use at Homer or how many fish they get, because I don't live there, and because subsistence is fishing, the usage is very personal. I mean, I right at the moment, I would not need nearly that much.
So could you... I'm trying to get an understanding of the difference between personal use fishing on the Kenai Peninsula and what you would like to do as a subsistence fisherman on the Kenai Peninsula.
What I would like to do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, there used to be a time when there wasn't a problem, and people just went after the seasons and fished for what they needed, put them up, and went home. And then nobody yelled about it because everybody was done fishing. The escapement had presumably been taken care of, and everything was healthy. And then everybody just took their fish and went home. It wasn't that much fun. Subsistence fishing is just to take what you need and put it away for the winter and for you and your family and go home. And the sooner you can do it, with the least fuss, the better.
Another question? Thank you. Mr. Johnson, song.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate. My name is Jonathan Solomon, and I come from the Yukon Flats. I'm an Athabascan Gwich'in, and I'm a member of the Gwich'in Steering Committee that was created in 1988 to defend the subsistence rights of the Gwich'in people in the Yukon Flats and parts of Canada. I want to make two statements. One is that Gwich'in people of Yukon Flat, the nine villages within the Yukon Flat, oppose the governor's bill. The second is that we support the Constitution Amendment. The record will show the Gwich'in people of Yukon Flat are 100% true subsistence users. The first 30 years of my life, I'm 60 years old right now, the first 30 years of my life, I subsist for a living with my uncles and my dad without interference from nobody in harmony with the animals and the land. Some types of legislators who are in territorial government come to rule Alaska and had a campaign in 1958 by types of people like Coghill and Buckervich and them type of people, and lied to the rural Alaskan people, telling us that if we go to statehood, that we would be voting to elect the president. But they failed to inform us that the state of Alaska only had three or some vote to elect a president, and we had no chance to elect a president. They didn't tell us that the state of Alaska would regulate us on the subsistence issues of fish and game. In 1958, my father and I, when we trap and hunt and fish, when we fish for our subsistence rights, we fish for 2 weeks out of each year for our need for the coming winter. Alaska became a state in 59 or so. In 1960, we had to fish 1 month. Somebody said that we were managing the fish more better than the federal government. To me, is not true. Because today, last year, my family had to fish over 90 days to get their need for the winter. we are the subsistent users of the Yukon Flat, Huachin people. Even when the commercial license were issued, we qualified for limited entry on the Yukon River. The Huachin people met and decided that we were not going to be commercial users. We're subsistent users, as our forefathers were. But there was only one limited entry fishing license issued in Fort Yukon. That's in the Yukon Flat, at the request of the elders. That was the only reason that we want to be law-abiding citizens, that when the elders can't fish, that this limited entry fishing permit would sell them the fish. That was the only reason that that one limited entry permit was issued in the Yukon Flat. We in the Yukon Flat, Huachin people, enjoy the federal oversight right now. I grew up under federal government's jurisdiction, territorial government, and we live our life without interference from nobody. Right now, with the seasonal coming around, with the fish and the ducks and the geese and the caribou and the moose, the tribal government within the nine villages meet with the fish and wildlife people and decide how we're going to handle this coming season on hunting or fishing. The tribal government is finally back in power in there. They're meeting right now in Rinitai, Alaska, where I should be enjoying my culture and talking about what's coming on. But at the request of the elders, I'm here because this is very important to us. We don't need any amendments. We don't need any law because we've got federal jurisdiction because we live in the Yukon Flat. It's all federal land where we can talk to the federal agency on a one-to-one basis. But we know that our fellow Alaskans are not in that same fix. Therefore, the Huachin people send me down here and say, hey, we're willing to give it up if we can get a constitution amendment to deal with the issues of subsistence. And tomorrow when I call them, and we need to know not very long, of what the Senate and the House is going to do. Because before July 1st of this year, we have what was known as Public Law 93-638, the Huachin people of Yukon Flat Tribal Government is going to put before the Secretary about contracting the fish and game, fish and wildlife enforcement in the Yukon Flat. But we are giving that if we can come up with a constitution amendment, we would not do that. We would go with what the people of the state of Alaska say to do. We need to hear from the people of the state of Alaska on this issue. Every individual voter of this great state. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
If there's any question, I'm willing to answer.
Senator Strzelecki, yes.
Mr. Chairman, Jonathan, that's a public law 93-638,
which says that any tribe can contract with the federal government on all programs that they serve to the native people.
Do you, is it very broad and it's not limited to health and education or so on?
No.
Has there ever been any definition or court cases to determine what that would include?
No.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. David O'David.
Thank you, John.
Next on the list is Mr. David O'David. You have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon.
Hello.
My name is David O'David from Greenup, and I'm here to represent my village, and I had a meeting just before I left with our elders which told me to pass the message on to Governor, and I was disappointed when I found out that it was Finance Committee that I was going to testify to. But
this is the
I feel a little better now since I already had time with the Governor, and I gave him the message that was sent from our elders. And if you want to know what the message was, you might as well, since you're working on the sufficiency, you might as well hear the message too. The message was from my elders, they don't want to be bothered in their subsistence way of whatever their subsistence is. They don't want anyone to tell them how to live their life and how to get their food and how not, and to limit them in getting their food because they say that they are living in their land, our land. And especially from the people, they don't want to be told how to live their life, especially from the people who move into their land and tell them how to live their life and limit them how to get resources from the land. That was the message from my elders back in the village. But you might well know too that I am one poor Eskimo to be here in representing my people and talk for them for their benefit, and me, my family, and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren and beyond that to come. We want to live our lives using the laws of our land, using the laws of the sea where we get our meat. We don't get caribou where I live. We use sea mammals for food as well as waterfowl. And we don't want to be limited in getting so, but I know that you are trying to make things better for people that live here, because you have been voted to work, and your work is your, as far as I'm concerned, your pen is your subsistence. And my subsistence is my rifle, shotgun, boat, net. Those are that's my subsistence. I don't work. I don't have a job. That's how come I told you that I was one poor Eskimo. I don't have money to my name, and I don't have money to leave my family after I'm gone. But I hope you'll have cotton, have enough money to buy cotton after when I die. And since I said that I don't have money, I have asked Mackay Campbell to donate some money to me to pay for my room at the hotel, but he's so damn tight that he would do it. The only thing he said was he offered me to have me move me to his daughter's bedroom. And I'm not interested in moving to his daughter's bedroom because I already have a room in a hotel. And I'm satisfied with what sleep I'm getting there. And another thing, that if I move into Mackay's room, he may keep me awake till the night late night asking me questions, what to subsist, how I subsist, and get me in the morning before I want to get up. Okay, I have said that we live by the laws of our land. We don't get more than we need, but if we do, by any chance, get more than we need, we share it with our people in the village who aren't able to get water for themselves. And another thing that I like you to know is I am independent Eskimo and I don't Yupik Eskimo and I don't depend on give a handout such as food stamps. That because when I was a kid, there were older people that used to tell me, "You poor thing, when you grow up and get married, you're going to starve your wife to death because you're so darn lazy, and you're not going to be able to support your wife." But up until we've been married 30 some years, and my wife's still alive. So in that case, I'd like to urge you, Senate Committee, to do your best in making our life in the village as best as you can, as well as the people in cities like Juneau. Is by any chance Mackay here to tell me that those what cities were in the book?
It's not here right at the moment.
Okay, Anchorage. But those people that are living in those areas are people. They're indigenous people. They're God-made people. Like you. They have red blood. They may have darker skin than you. And black hair, but they're still human beings. And we can think for, we may be natives, but we are indigenous people of Alaska, and we can make decisions. We should make decisions for ourselves and think for ourselves. If we can't do that, Al Adams wouldn't be sitting over there who learned how to live your way of life. If he can do it, I could do it too, but I'm so damn lazy to be cooped up in the house and not do nothing and look at the papers. I'd like to be out free and free to do anything and not have anybody tell me what to do and hunt food for my family as well as for my grandchildren. And my I shouldn't say I had any great-grandchildren, but my grandkids said that I have a big family, and I do my best to hunt and feeding them. And whatever little money I get, I use the money to buy things that I could go out hunting with, such as gas, ammunition, and those things. But I don't intend to ask the state for food stamps. I don't like that. Because I am, some people have said that I was too independent to depend on somebody, and I guess I am. But I like to, again, urge you, Senate Committee, to do your best and look at Governor's Bill and trash it if you have to. But amendment, whatever the Constitution amendment is.